practice of meditation.
And they tend to be very schematic and brief. I believe that this was because when the Buddha taught meditation, it was probably very immediate living process, giving meditation instruction to groups of followers in a living way. And what's preserved are very brief schematic structures. In particular, one very important critical sutta in the tradition over the centuries of meditation has been the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness, has been used as a foundation for all the different variations and techniques of Vipassana meditation that are practiced in the world today. They all claim heritage from the Satipatthana Sutta. The Satipatthana Sutta was given by the Lord Buddha to the Kuru people, a group in India, and the commentary to the text says that in the next generation or two, the Kuru people would meet when they met by the well or the village square. Their favorite topic of conversation was, and what foundation of mindfulness do you practice? And these were people that were very devoted to the Dhamma and the practice of Bhavana. And this is why the Buddha chose to give the discourse in this community, was because he saw their potential. So this is one of the really important suttas. It's actually quite brief and is more in the nature of a summary or a scheme that can be filled out, that needs to be filled out and fleshed out to turn it into a practical system of meditation practice. And it's full of very short cryptic phrases that can be and have been interpreted in different ways. To begin with, it talks about establishing mindfulness, sati, and we use that word mindfulness a lot in talking about the Dhamma. It's one of the really important teachings, but it's so important it's often assumed that we know what the meaning is, and it's skimmed over. We talk about mindfulness quite loosely, but what exactly is meant by mindfulness? The Pali word sati is the same as the Sanskrit word smriti is. Originally meant memory, and we see in the some of the old translations of the suttas, sati is translated as recollectedness, to preserve this kind of etymological link. You seldom see that anymore. Mindfulness has become the established translation, but the link with memory is quite important, and it's not really obvious, but the idea is that we remember to be present, we remember to be conscious. So we when we're practicing meditation, and the mind wanders away from the exercise, then that moment when you bring the mind back is when you remember to be mindful again. And it takes a constant presence of this remembering that we should be mindful to maintain a meditation. Mindfulness, sati, basically means that we're present, that we're conscious of the contents of consciousness. Whether we practice meditation or not, whether we've ever heard of meditation or not, that the mind in each moment of our life is taking an object. It's the nature of consciousness to do this, to take an object. The untrained mind, for the untrained mind, the stream of objects is erratic and confused. But the mind that's practicing vipassana is the mind that is attempting to be conscious of the objects in a methodical way. So the difference is that instead of the objects being a confused mass of impressions and reactions, we try and gain some inner calm, inner peace and space, inner space, so that we see the objects one after the other, and we're conscious of the objects, conscious of their arising and conscious of their passing away. Now, this is easier said than done. It takes a lot of practice to be good at it. One of the important aspects is the development of samatha practice, tranquility work. Thus, any meditation which is based on a narrow focus of consciousness is classed as samatha. In Buddhism, we talk about two basic kinds of meditation are samatha and vipassana. And they go together harmoniously. Ajahn Chah used to say that samadhi leads to wisdom, and wisdom leads to samadhi. But these are the two sides. Samadhi being concentration, an important aspect of samatha, and wisdom being penetration of reality, which is the results of vipassana. So we practice samatha by narrowing the focus of consciousness and deliberately choosing a single focus, which in most Buddhist traditions is very often the breath. But it doesn't need to be. There are other objects that we can use. But focusing on the breath is a very good type of samatha practice, where the mind narrows, deliberately narrow the focus of the mind to the sensation of the breath, and the point of contact. We usually use for samatha, it's usually recommended to use the nostril, where the breath impacts the sensitive nostrils. So we have this sensation of contact of the air as the focus. And we try and make it as narrow as possible and as one-pointed as possible. And this can lead to a very deep, stable frame of mind. And we let the other objects slide away. We don't pay attention to them. So by practicing this way, we can gain some space and clarity in the mind. So then when we do turn the mind to vipassana practice, then it becomes possible to do it fruitfully. And the Satipatthana Sutta is all about the vipassana, which means vipassana is clear seeing. Now this is the other type of meditation taught in Buddhism, and it's the vehicle for liberation, and it's the type of meditation that's unique to the Buddha's dispensation. Samatha practice is known to other religions, other philosophies, but vipassana was a unique discovery of the Buddha. It means clear seeing, clear knowing, clear looking. And it's very difficult to arouse enough sati to do vipassana if you haven't got calm, if you haven't got clarity in space. It is possible to do, and it's taught in many places, a dry or bare vipassana, where you don't do any samatha, you just do vipassana. And some people have success with this, but in general, it's a rough-edged sort of practice. It's quite difficult to do. Even if you do some samatha work, when you first do vipassana, you might find it difficult. It's a common experience for new meditators when they go on retreat for the first time, and they doing vipassana for after they've been doing it for 3 or 4 days. If they're working diligently and seriously, they'll very commonly reach a point where they believe they're going crazy. They'll come and tell the teacher, "I'm going mad." What's happening is that they're perceiving the mind as a confused babble of thoughts, and this is a very common experience. And what I believe is happening is that they've gained enough conscious awareness of their thought process that they're seeing it clearly for the first time. That their thought process, their whole life has been this confused babble, and they've been buffeted around by it, and reacting in a confused and emotional way to the situations in their life without being conscious of their own thought processes. Now they're becoming aware of just how confused and jumbled it is, and it's a bit scary. But if they persist and they have the courage to stay with it, it won't be too long till they cut through that confusion and reach a space of clarity and begin to separate the elements of the mind. So in the going back to our text, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha talks about going to a quiet place and sitting down and putting mindfulness in the forefront, setting up mindfulness. Some translations you'll see a confusing phrase, mindfulness put out in front. Some interpret the Adimukha in a literal physical way, that somehow you're supposed to project the mindfulness out in front. It's confusing. What it just means, putting mindfulness as the primary mental quality, that you're basing your state of mind on sati, on mindfulness, making it the most important thing. Putting aside covetousness and grief concerning the world. That's a very simple little phrase, but there's many levels of meaning in this, and it's very important. On the coarse level, on the very immediate level of interpretation, it just means putting aside worldly concerns and not being involved in planning your next work project or your next vacation when you should be meditating. But it really cuts a lot deeper and subtler than that, and it goes to the core of the whole practice. When we look at the Four Noble Truths, we see that the teaching that suffering is caused by tanha, desire, it's usually translated desire. And there's different kinds of tanha. There's craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. And all these lead to suffering. The craving for sensual desire is basically a kind of deep restlessness, that the mind is not satisfied or content with the universe as it presents itself to consciousness at this moment. So it either wants some pleasurable object that's out of its reach, or it wants to push aside some unpleasant object that's thrusting itself upon it. So the mind is not content. It's a restlessness. It's a movement. Yeah. And this comes from the reaction to the feelings, to vedana. The mind takes, consciousness takes an object, which is an automatic process. An object presents itself to consciousness, mind takes the object. Then mind judges the object. Now this is a very fundamental part of our mental life, is that objects are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is very, very deep-rooted part of our mental life, that we classify the universe in this way. And this process too is quite automatic. And in itself, purely in itself, it's not problematic. It's simply the way things are. The mind experiences pleasure, pain, or indifference. Where it becomes a problem is in the next stage, where the mind then grasps with desire after pleasant sensation and acts with repulsion or aversion towards unpleasant sensation. And also, even more subtly, is in ignorance or non-knowing, non-seeing of neutral sensations. So when we cast aside covetousness and grief concerning the world, we're really trying to break this process. This is the stage of dependent origination that we're trying to break. Is this the link from feeling to craving? So we're trying to allow the experience of the sensations, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant, but just allow those to come into consciousness without grasping. This non-grasping, non-holding, is really the key to the practice of vipassana and the key to liberation. And it's really so subtle and so difficult to do, because we're trying to break an inveterate habit of mind, a habit of mind that goes back many, many lifetimes, eons of time, and that is the driving force. It's actually the engine that drives samsara and drives us from existence to existence and birth to birth. Is this craving and aversion. So we're trying to simply rest with the reality as it is. And this can include the part of the reality of things as they are is our own reaction to them. So we're trying with the Vipassana practice not to grasp onto anything, to see each object clearly for a moment and let it go. Now, one of the subtle ways that we lose it and we practice clinging in meditation is that the mind in meditation will throw up all manner of things. You know, or will have all kinds of thoughts, memories, images, visions, physical sensations. All manner of things will be thrown up. And then, if we're not careful, then we can become fascinated with certain objects. You know, for example, trains of thought. If the mind goes off on a train of thought, speculating, thinking about something, then you've lost the stream of awareness, because you're getting inside and identifying with the contents of consciousness. Now there's a very important insight into how this process works. Something I read a while back, it was written by a Westerner who teaches meditation, and he once asked a Burmese meditation teacher why it seems that they have more success in Burma with the Vipassana practice than the Westerners often have difficulties. And the answer was that the Westerners often don't practice it properly. They, instead of practicing Vipassana, they do self-psychoanalysis. And this writer went on to explain that by saying that the mistake is made to become interested with the content of the mind as primary instead of the process of mind. So I think that's a very important distinction to make, that it's easy to become fascinated with the contents of our own story, and to become distracted from the process of meditation by when a memory arises, or the mind makes some connection that seems important, then we can get lost in a long train of speculation and self-examination and storytelling, and we've lost the thread of the Vipassana, which is properly done, correctly done, is an examination of the processes of mind. Our story is, our own personal story is of interest only because it's the only case study of dukkha that we have in detail. That's what we have to work with. But it's really it's really of secondary importance. It's a springboard. Should be a springboard. You should be moving from the personal to the general, and from the general to the universal, and trying to understand the actual processes of things on a level that's very immediate and fundamental. So looking at the way the mind takes an object, the way the mind reacts to an object, the way craving arises, the way grief arises, and when these various states of mind arise, they should be seen themselves as objects. Objects of consciousness, and as process, as linked by cause and effect. we can learn a lot by looking at how these things arise and how they pass away. Another repeated phrase in the Satipatthana Sutta is contemplating origination factors and contemplating dissolution factors. So it's watching this process of movement. One way of doing this is when you're practicing meditation and you've lost the thread of the meditation and the mind wanders, and then your mind will catch itself and you'll remember, you'll practice, you'll bring sati back and you'll remember, oh, I've gone off. That first moment is very interesting, very revealing, when the mind returns to sati. Then you can see the origination of wholesome qualities at that moment. And when the mind becomes quiet enough, and you can get some space between the thoughts, you can see thoughts arising and you can see them passing away. It's not that we're trying, in meditation, it should never be thought that we're trying to throttle the thought process. We're not trying to stupefy ourselves. We're trying to gain some calm and space and clarity so that we can see the thought process consciously. And we're not identifying with it. We're not getting inside it and writing it. And we're seeing the thoughts arise, treating them as an object of consciousness. In the Buddhist psychology, we divide consciousness into six, according to the six sense bases. There's the five physical senses that we're eye, ear, nose, tongue, and touch. And there's also the mind sense, which takes mind objects, dhammas, which are thoughts, memories, emotions. These are dhammas. So in the Buddhist way of looking at the mind process sense contact, thoughts are parallel to objects of vision or sounds. They're objects, they're contents of consciousness. In the Abhidhamma, there's a clear distinction of categories between citta and cittasaka, that is, between that which knows, conscious mind, and the chittasaka are the objects that go along with consciousness, that is, thoughts, emotions, memories, feelings. They are the objective side of mind, and consciousness is the subjective side. Now there is, it's a little bit complicated because there is an element of volition involved in thinking, and we make kama with thinking, so it is something we do. It isn't just a neutral thing that happens to us. It is something we do. But from the point of view of practicing vipassana, what we're trying to do is to withdraw this element of volition as much as possible. You know, we're trying to practice choiceless awareness. This is a very important phrase, choiceless awareness. We're practicing non-discrimination amongst the objects of consciousness. We don't discriminate. We don't pick and choose. This is a good object. This is a bad object. I like this one. I think I'm going to hang on to this one for a bit and play with it. You know, you try not to do that. We let each object come and go. So another example, something that people can get lost in and attached to in meditation is visions
and strong experiences in meditation. You can have the nimittas, they're called. The mind can create objects. As the mind gets some calm and clarity, one of the things that happens is it develops a strong power of visualization. So it'll throw up images. And I've seen meditators get very fascinated by these images, and they look for hidden meanings, and they make a great fuss about images thrown up in meditation. But they should just be regarded as objects of consciousness, the same as anything else. And just note it as seeing. It's just the mind creating an object, and we're just seeing this object. And we should be more interested in the process to see how these images arise and pass away, and not to get lost and wander. And you can get stuck for a very long time in this in imagery. So the Satipatthana Sutta goes on, besides laying out some general principles, it goes on to list four foundations of mindfulness. There's four areas that it's fruitful to use as areas of investigation, things to examine with the mind. Areas of vipassana. The first one, and the four move from coarse to subtle. And the first one is the body. We take the body as an object of consciousness. Ajahn Sumedho likes to has said a few times, he likes to say that the body should be considered as within the mind, not the mind within the body. So you take the body in into the mind, take it into consciousness, consider the processes of the body. And there's specific ways of doing this. Satipatthana Sutta begins with talking about mindfulness of breathing. Now, in the context of vipassana practice, this is different than in the process of tranquility practice. And this is why in the Burmese tradition of Mahasi Sayadaw, he recommended using the movement of the breath at the abdomen for vipassana, as a basis for vipassana. And it's a very good vehicle for that, because it's a broad object. It's not, so you don't become one-pointed. So if you're practicing for awareness, you don't want to become too one-pointed. So it's a bit more difficult to use the nose tip as a basis for vipassana. It's excellent for samatha, but it's a bit more difficult for, not impossible. Some people do have success with it, but it's more difficult because the focus is narrow. When we look at the rising and falling motion, either of the abdomen, or another variation is the diaphragm, to go right inside and watch the diaphragm move. When we watch these coarse physical processes, we can see the origination factors and the dissolution factors, and see the body moving, coming into one type of existence and passing away from it and going into another. And we can see the body as a flux. And this type of practice is, would also be supported by the phrase breathing in with the considering the whole body, breathing out considering the whole body. That's usually glossed as the breath body, but that's a commentarial addition. It's the Pali text, the original Pali text is just a mindful of the whole body, he breathes in. Mindful of the whole body, he breathes out. So it's a meditation that's based on the body, you know, rather than the tranquility meditation, which is attempting to focus the mind on a single point. We're here trying to gain consciousness of the body, take the body into consciousness. The next type of body meditation or area of contemplation mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta is meditation on the postures. The postures are generally classified as, in general terms, as four: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. But of course, there's endless variations. And this just basically means to be conscious, aware of the position of the body, the disposition of the limbs, to be aware of any movements of the body. So in doing any kind of Vipassana meditation, it's very important to be conscious, completely conscious of any movement of the body, any change of postures. It's very critical. It's good to sit still. It's not absolutely essential to sit like a rock and never move for the whole hour. But if you do shift your posture, to be very, very conscious of it. And first of all, you should notice, say that you're sitting and your leg is becoming cramped and you want to recross your legs the other way or shift your weight, then first to become aware of the discomfort, aware that there's physical discomfort. Then be aware of the intention to move. That the body doesn't move itself, it's always moved by the mind, and the mind will come up first with the intention, the volition to move. And then to move very slowly and mindfully and be aware of the change of postures. So we take every stage of this process as objects of consciousness, as contents of citta. So we don't do anything unconsciously. We're quite aware of what we're doing. You should never thrash your limbs about in meditation. Never should never make sudden movements. I remember one meditator that was at my center at the Arrow River, who would sit very tight, very stiff for the whole hour until the bell rang, and then he would just go like a coiled spring. He'd flail his arms and legs out, release the tension. Getting to this, understanding this point of intention of movement is very important. It's actually a very important gateway, and if you become quite fluent at noticing the intentions to move, then look for subtler intentions. Look for the intention to swallow, for example. It's a bodily process that the mouth fills with saliva, and it causes discomfort, and periodically we swallow the saliva. You should try never, when you're doing Vipassana meditation, you should try never to swallow without having previously noticed all these stages. Notice the discomfort from the heaviness in the mouth, and then notice the intention to swallow, then notice the contraction and movement of the body swallowing. If the eyes are open, if you're doing walking meditation or even sitting meditation with eyes open, notice the intention to blink. This is going even one more step subtle. If you get very good with this noticing of intentions, then you can transfer it from the physical to the mental and notice the intention to think. Now, this is getting to a very good level of vipassana when you notice, before a thought even arises, you notice that there's the first subtle movement of mind. There's an intention to think. I can only compare it in a kind of an analogy to like a bubble coming up out of a liquid. You know, you just out of the mind, the thought arises in a very subtle form first. And this gets back to this point of an element of volition in thinking. So we can, if we're really good with the vipassana and our mind is very calm and there's a good deal of clarity and space in the mind, then we can notice this volition before the thought arises. And then we can keep the mind very quiet. Then there is the returning to the meditations on the body. There is then a paragraph that describes all the activities of the body that we can apply mindfulness to. Walking to and fro, eating, going to the toilet, like every possible thing that we do with the body in the course of the day. So this is a refinement of meditation of the postures. This is taking it to a more broader perspective. So for example, when you're on a meditation like this, a day's retreat or a longer retreat, pay particular attention to those times when you change postures. When you go from walking meditation to sitting meditation, try to pay particular attention to that process. As you're walking outside, you hear the bell, you come inside and sit down. Don't allow the mind to wander away during that time. Be aware of the body at that time. What's the body doing? Opening the door, crossing the hall, looking at the seat, sitting down, adjusting the limbs, this whole process. And when we eat the meal today, now try and... eating the meal is a time when the mind can really wander off because there's a great deal of sense impressions happening. Try and be as conscious as possible in eating. One simple way of encouraging mindfulness while eating is, while eating one spoonful, don't be digging around in the plate for the next. You're either eating or scooping. You're not doing both. So try to practice that way and see how many times you lose it. And bring yourself back. But try and not be digging in the plate for the next spoonful when you have, until the mouth is empty. Then there is the meditation on the 32 parts of the body, which is a methodical, discursive type of meditation where you go through a list of the parts of the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. those first five are the external parts, so you can just use those, or you can go through the whole list, which goes on hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrows, kidneys, lungs, liver, membranes, bowels, intestines, stomach, contents of stomach, blood, phlegm, pus. The list is you can find in various places. And it's in the Satipatthana Sutta. It's also elsewhere. It's not hard to find. The purpose of this is to learn to visualize the body in a new way, rather than seeing it. We tend to see the body only two-dimensionally from the outside. We see the outside surface of the body, and we also see it with a biased perception, that we choose to see it as attractive and beautiful. We see those aspects of the body. We also see it as a compact mass. We see it as one unitary thing. Now this is taking another deliberate pile of organs hung on bones. Okay? It's this kind of complicated thing. So this also breaks up the self-view attachment to the body, because it breaks up the sense of the body as a compact mass, and you see the body as being made up of bits and pieces. Another way of doing this, in a more abstract way, is the next meditation, which is contemplation of the four elements. That's seeing the body in terms of what's usually called earth, air, fire, and water. We shouldn't understand those in a naive way. It's not meant to be physical earth, air, water, and fire. It's meant to be four qualities. And there's earth. Earth is patawi, is hardness. Hardness or softness. It's the quality. One way is defined as the quality of extension, the quality of taking up space. Water is the quality of, it's also called the quality of cohesion, or viscosity. That's sort of the fluid nature of the body, the way that quality of the body. Air is movement, and fire is heat or coldness. So by examining these qualities, seeing the body in terms of these abstract qualities, then we also break down a self-view attached to the body and begin to see it in an abstract way, as in an objective way. And the last body-based contemplation in the sutta is contemplation of the body as impermanent, by visualizing the body dead and rotting as a corpse, and going through different stages of the body's decay. And that can be quite a powerful contemplation. Sometimes it's still done in Thailand at least, and elsewhere, I think, it's still done in with an actual physical external corpse. That they have, they'll bring a dead body to the monastery, and the monks can take turns sitting beside the body and contemplating it. But you can also do it just strictly mentally, and you can imagine your own body. You can go through the phases of decay, imagining your own body rotting away. And there's actually a list of particular phases of different stages. And if it's done according to that list, which goes from bloated, livid corpse, and then flesh rotting away, and a skeleton with some flesh remaining, then just a skeleton, and then the skeleton scattered, and then raked together into a pile and rotting away to dust, and then the dust disintegrating into the earth. You go from a rather disturbing, even violent image, because one of the stages is dogs and birds tearing at the body. You go to peacefulness, and finally to voidness. You imagine the body as dust, bones, yellow bones bleached in the sun, and then dust, and then the dust disappears, and you're left with a peaceful, empty state of mind. This is a version too of Maranasati, which is contemplation on death, which is bring up awareness of impermanency, which is very important, that we come to be conscious of the transient nature of body and mind. So a large part of the Satipatthana Sutta is dealing with this different forms of contemplation of body, meditation on the body. And you can take that as a main vehicle, meditating on the body. It's a very very commonly done, very important meditation. The other stages, the other stations of mindfulness, the next one is feelings, vedana. And you're probably familiar with the idea of what this means, but I'll go over it because it's important to make the distinction that the word feelings that's commonly used to translate vedana is not the same as we use feelings in colloquial English. It's not nearly so broad. We're not talking about emotions, all these complicated things. We're talking about a very primitive level of mind with feelings. It's the immediate reaction of mind to classify things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There are different classifications of feelings, but they all come down to this one simple triplet: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. They can also be regarded as purely mental or with a physical aspect, so that painful feeling in the body, like a pain in the body, a pain in the back or the leg or whatever, is vedana, or as unpleasant feeling, painful feeling in the, associated with the body. Or there can be purely mental vedana, such as grief or sadness at the loss of a family member is purely mental aspect of vedana. It's also, particularly in the Satipatthana Sutta, they talk about worldly and unworldly feelings. What's meant by that is that pleasant feeling, for example, is either based on sense pleasures. A pleasant feeling is either based on sense pleasures or on the bliss of jhana. Bliss of meditation is a pleasant feeling that has nothing to do with the sense basis. But this, it's still just pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling. And what we're trying to do when we take these as objects of meditation is just to see them as they are. And in particular, this one unpleasant feeling rooted in the body is one that is important to look at. And it's worth saying a few words about. It's again is a common thing for meditators to experience pains in the body. And a large part of this is just from sitting still. If you're not used to it, the quality of dukkha in the body, pain in the body, is said to be masked by change in the postures. What that means is that the body is naturally full of dukkha, unpleasant feelings. It's a natural state of the body, but that we hide it from ourselves by fidgeting. We keep shifting our posture, and people. There's a story about a meditation teacher who would get her students to sit in a. When they first came to see her, she'd get them to sit in a comfortable chair, some soft, easy chair, and she'd say, "Take your time, make yourself as comfortable as you can." And are you perfectly comfortable, perfectly at ease? When they said yes, she'd say, "Okay, now I want you not to move. Don't move a muscle." And then she'd start talking, and it wouldn't take long, usually 3 or 4 minutes, they'd start to fidget. And she'd say, "I thought you said you were perfectly comfortable. What are you moving for?" It's the nature of the body. So when we have unpleasant feelings arise in the body in meditation, the real way through that in the end, I mean, there's things you can do like stretching, and you try to make yourself more accustomed to sitting by doing yoga, and all those things can help, but in the end it's really just coming to terms with and accepting that the body will hurt. It's the nature of samsara. The body is going to throw up pains, and then when you get to the point where it doesn't matter anymore, you just notice the physical sensation of pain. That's what it is. It's just as it is. It's not same as a pleasurable sensation. It's just as it is. And we don't put an added level of craving on top of it. We don't wish to be away from the pain. We just notice it. The physical pains, instead of becoming a hindrance to meditation, they become a vehicle of insight. So that's part of contemplation of feelings. Contemplation of mental contents, of objects of consciousness, sankharas, is given in the Satipatthana Sutta in terms of various lists of dhammas, beginning with the five hindrances. It's very very important to be conscious of and aware of these unwholesome states of mind when they arise in meditation, to be aware of sense desire when it arises, to be aware of ill will, of agitation, of skeptical doubt, and of sloth and torpor, or laziness. To treat these two as objects of consciousness. And if you can get outside of them and objectify them, see them as unwholesome qualities arising in the mind, it's easier to let them go. The problem is when we get inside of them, identify with them, and take ownership of them, then they can become chronic and we can be burdened with them. But if they just arise as a passing, a momentary occurrence of the mind, then there's no problem. Just see them, let them go. You can also look at the wholesome qualities of mind arising. Seven enlightenment factors. Mindfulness in the middle. Mindfulness is the first and most important of the enlightenment factors. Then there's the three energizing factors of investigation, rapture or joy, and energy or effort. And the three calming factors of tranquility, equanimity, and concentration. So seeing mental objects and knowing them. Now this is an important aspect of having these lists, is that they allow us to have some precision in our meditation. We can see when things arise to the mind, we can understand them. Say, this is laziness. This is sloth and torpor. This is energy. I'm feeling energetic now. We can begin to add some precision into our meditation, into kind of some knowledge in our mental life. The last satipatthana is mental qualities, the qualities of citta. It's given into the citta is described in the Satipatthana Sutta in terms of qualities like mind with lust, mind without lust, mind with anger, without anger, contracted mind, expanded mind, exalted mind, mundane mind, supramundane mind. The reason it goes like that is because we're talking about citta, consciousness here, and we're coming close to the real core and central mystery of the mind. Talking about citta, we're getting to a very subtle level now. We've moved from the coarse to the subtle, and actually objectifying the subjective. So the mind that knows, the one that knows, Puru in Thai, is not really possible to take that. It's not really possible to take that as an object of consciousness, because it is itself the subjective quality. So we can only get at it sideways, so to speak. And one way is to do this by considering the qualities of mind, the associated mental factors. Whenever we do any type of vipassana, we're actually getting at the nature of citta, because when you take body or feelings or mental objects, you're also taking the citta, because the citta is in part defined by its contents. Now, it makes no sense without an object. Consciousness takes an object, knows an object. So to get at that, to understand the process of citta, one way is by looking at the objects of consciousness, which is really the whole of the vipassana practice, is methodically looking at the objects of consciousness to understand the processes of mind. So there's a lot more that could be said about this topic, but we're running out of time, and I'll wrap it up and just say that this recommend that this is a sutta that's well worth studying and contemplating the teachings in the sutta, going through the different lists and taking them in and contemplating what they might mean. What might the Buddha have meant when he said this? So I wish you all success in your meditation, and may you be well and happy and gain to liberation in this very lifetime.